You ever think about how, like when you see a group of people doing something illegal, proving that they were all in on it together, like part of the same plan? Seems pretty straightforward,
Yeah,
right?
you'd think so.
But the law, well, it likes to take a deeper dive, you know what I mean? And today, well, we're diving headfirst into this 11th Circuit case, United States v. Cole.
Oh, an interesting one for sure.
It really digs into how you go about proving a single conspiracy, especially when we're talking about a drug smuggling operation on a truly massive scale.
I mean, just to give you a sense of the scope here, we're talking about a $100 million operation moving over 500,000 pounds of marijuana
Wow.
between 1977 and 1981, no less.
That's a lot of weed.
It really makes you think about the logistics of something that big, right?
Definitely.
And then on top of that, the legal hurdles involved in proving it was all one coordinated effort.
Yeah, I mean, that's the real deep dive here, right? Like, how do you untangle something of that magnitude?
Absolutely. It's a perfect example of the legal system wrestling with a criminal enterprise that's just, well, huge.
Okay, so we've laid out the scale, the time frame. Now let's get to the heart of it, the central question for today's deep dive. In an operation of this size, with all these moving parts, was there actually enough evidence to say, definitively, that all these different people were part of one big conspiracy? Or was it just a bunch of separate, smaller deals happening, kind of coincidentally around the same time?
That's the crux of it. The prosecution built their case on the idea that this was a single overarching conspiracy with Donald Rawlerson at the center of it all.
Okay, so we have our alleged mastermind. What about the others? What were they actually doing that got them tangled up in this whole legal mess?
Well, the evidence presented at trial really painted a picture of a very complex division of labor.
Like specific roles and everything.
Exactly. You had individuals who were directly involved in the physical movement of the marijuana.
So, like, hands-on stuff.
Yeah, literally offloading shipments from boats and airplanes as they arrived.
Okay, then what?
Then you had folks who handled the logistics, which, considering the sheer quantity, was no small feat.
Right. I mean, moving that much marijuana can't be easy.
Not at all. So you had people transporting it, weighing it, all those crucial
And
steps.
someone had to get it in the first place, right?
Of course. That's where the individuals who traveled to Colombia to buy the marijuana came in.
So you've got the buyers, the transporters, the offloaders. Sounds like a well-oiled machine almost.
It did seem rather organized, yes. And that's precisely the point the prosecution was driving at. This wasn't just a series of random, unconnected events. It was a sustained, coordinated effort with all these different parts working towards a common goal.
And that common goal being obviously to make a whole lot of money from all that marijuana. Okay, so we've got this intricate network, years of activity, and alleged mastermind. But let's take a step back and look at the legal framework here. To prove a conspiracy, what exactly does the prosecution have to convince the court of?
Well, they have to meet what we call the three-part test.
Okay, break it down for me.
First, they have to demonstrate that there was an agreement.
An agreement to do what specifically?
In this case, to import and distribute marijuana illegally.
Got it. So agreement's number one. What's next?
Second, they have to prove that the defendant, the specific person they're trying to convict, knew about this agreement.
So not just that the agreement existed, but that the person was actually aware of it. Makes sense. And the third part?
The third element is voluntary participation. The prosecution has to show that the defendant willingly took part in this illegal scheme. They weren't coerced or tricked into it.
Okay, so to recap, we need agreement, knowledge, and voluntary participation.
Right.
Those are the three pillars of a conspiracy charge. But here's the thing, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are thinking this too. Proving those elements, especially in a case this big, must be incredibly difficult. You're not going to find a signed contract or a confession saying, "Yep, I was knowingly part of this massive drug smuggling ring."
Right, you hit the nail on the head. Direct evidence like that is pretty rare in conspiracy cases.
So how do they do it? What kind of evidence do they use?
That's where circumstantial evidence comes in.
Okay, give me some examples. What kind of things would fall under that category?
Things like financial records, showing payments between individuals, or coordinated actions that point towards a shared plan. Communication patterns can be revealing too, and sometimes the sheer scale and interconnectedness of the operation itself can be pretty compelling circumstantial evidence.
So if they can show a clear pattern of behavior, even without a smoking gun, that can be enough to sway a jury.
Exactly. The prosecution essentially has to weave together a story using all these pieces of circumstantial evidence to convince the jury that a conspiracy existed and that the defendant was a knowing and voluntary participant.
I can see how that would be a tough job, both for the prosecution and for the defense.
Mm-hmm.
Because the defense could argue, hey, my client just happened to be there when a boat was being unloaded. They had no idea what was inside those boxes. Or they might say, sure, my client made a few deliveries, but they thought it was a one-time thing. They had no clue they were part of something bigger.
You're right. That's a classic defense strategy in these cases. They try to portray their clients as having limited involvement, no knowledge of the bigger picture, no intent to be part of a long-term conspiracy.
And that brings us to a crucial question. How does the court differentiate between one giant conspiracy and a bunch of smaller, independent ones that just happen to overlap? What are the guidelines they use?
Well, the courts have developed what they call single conspiracy factors. These are specific elements that tend to suggest a unified operation as opposed to multiple separate ones.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What are these factors?
The first, and arguably the most important, is a common goal. In Cole, that was the importation and distribution of marijuana for profit.
Mm.
Everyone was working towards the same end.
Makes sense. What's the next factor?
Second, we look at the nature of the scheme itself. Was it a spontaneous, one-off thing, or a more structured, long-term operation? In Cole, we're talking about a four-year operation with defined roles for different participants, which leans heavily towards a single conspiracy.
Right. It had a certain level of sophistication and organization that wouldn't really fit with a bunch of random, unconnected deals.
Exactly. And the third key factor is the overlap among participants. Do we see the same people popping up in different roles and different events throughout the alleged conspiracy?
So if the same group of people is involved in buying the drugs, transporting them, and selling them over multiple trips, that strengthens the case for a single conspiracy.
Precisely. That kind of repeated involvement and interconnectedness suggests that they were all working together as part of a larger plan, not just coincidentally involved in similar activities.
Okay, I think I'm starting to get a better grasp on these single conspiracy factors. But let's get back to the Cole case specifically. What did the 11th Circuit actually think about the evidence presented at trial? Did they agree that it supported the jury's finding of a single conspiracy?
They did. Judge Hatchett, who wrote the majority opinion, really emphasized the significance of circumstantial evidence in these cases.
So even without direct proof, the circumstantial evidence can be powerful enough to convince the court.
Yes, because it all comes down to reasonable inferences. The court stated pretty clearly that you don't need a signed confession or a video recording of the agreement. The jury can look at the actions and conduct of the individuals involved and make a reasonable deduction about whether an agreement existed.
And what specific pieces of evidence did they point to in Cole?
Well, they highlighted the way the marijuana was offloaded, you know, the coordination involved. They also looked at the financial transactions, which seemed to link different participants. But the most compelling evidence, in their view, was the recurring overlap in participants. The same people kept showing up in different phases of the smuggling operation across multiple trips.
So the court was saying, look, these people weren't just randomly involved in separate drug deals. They were all part of a larger network, working towards a common goal.
That's the essence of their argument. And they specifically mentioned the common goal of importing and distributing this huge quantity of marijuana as the unifying thread that tied everything together.
Okay, so even if someone was only involved in one aspect of the operation, like just offloading a single shipment, the court could still consider that evidence of their participation in the larger conspiracy.
That's a crucial takeaway here. The court basically said that if you knowingly participate in any phase of a single unified scheme, that can be seen as evidence that you joined the conspiracy, even if you weren't involved in every step of the process.
But what about the defense argument? You know, that these were just a bunch of similar but separate deals. How did the court address that?
They acknowledged that there were multiple trips and that some people might have had different roles from one trip to another, but they emphasized that the common goal, the structured nature of the operation, and the significant overlap in participants were enough for a reasonable jury to conclude that it was one big conspiracy, not a bunch of small ones.
It sounds like the appellate court gave a lot of weight to the jury's decision in this case.
Yeah.
They weren't quick to overturn it.
Absolutely. They made it very clear that they weren't there to retry the case or second guess the jury's findings. Their job was to determine whether a reasonable jury, after hearing all the evidence, could have reached a guilty verdict. And in Cole, they decided that, yes, a reasonable jury could have found the defendants guilty based on the evidence presented.
So their primary focus was on whether there was enough evidence to legally support the verdict, not on whether they personally agreed with the jury's decision.
Exactly. It's about respecting the role of the jury in our legal system. Now, Cole also brings up some procedural aspects that are worth mentioning, especially for our law student listeners.
You're talking about the bill of particulars and the severance request, right?
Yes. These are legal maneuvers that the defense can use in certain situations.
Okay, remind me what those are all about.
A bill of particulars is basically a request from the defense for more detailed information about the charges against their clients. In Cole, the defendants wanted the prosecution to provide a more specific breakdown of each person's role in the conspiracy. Like, what exactly did they do? When did they do it? That kind of thing.
And why did they want that information?
Well, from a defense perspective, the more specific the accusations are, the easier it is to prepare a defense. They can focus their efforts on addressing those specific allegations.
So it's about having enough information to mount a proper defense.
Right. But in Cole, the court denied their request for a bill of particulars.
Why was that?
The court felt that the original indictment, the document outlining the charges, was already detailed enough. They said that making the prosecution provide even more granular details at that early stage would be overly burdensome, especially given the complexity and scale of the case.
Makes sense. If the indictment lays out the basic framework of the alleged conspiracy, the defense can't necessarily demand a minute-by-minute account of every single participant's actions right off the bat.
Exactly. The court has to balance the need for fairness with the need for efficiency. Now, the other procedural issue was the severance request.
Okay, remind me what that one's about.
A severance request is basically a defendant saying, I want to be tried separately from my co-defendants.
So instead of one big trial with everyone together, they're asking for individual trials.
Exactly. In Cole, some of the defendants argued that a joint trial would be unfair to them. They were worried that the jury might get confused or prejudiced by the evidence against their co-defendants, even if that evidence wasn't directly relevant to their own actions.
So they felt like they might get lumped in with the others and convicted based on guilt by association, even if their own involvement was minimal.
That's the concern. But the court denied the severance requests in Cole.
Why was that?
They basically said that since the government had presented evidence suggesting a single conspiracy, the evidence against any one defendant was relevant to the case as a whole. It all fit together as part of the same criminal enterprise.
So, if everyone is supposedly part of the same conspiracy, it makes sense to try them together, right? The evidence against one person could shed light on the actions of others.
That's the logic. And it shows how proving a single conspiracy can really tie the defendants together, making it harder for them to argue for separate trials.
This Cole case is a real eye-opener. It really highlights the complexities of proving agreement and shared intent in these large-scale criminal operations. As we wrap up this deep dive, what are the key takeaways you'd want our listeners to remember?
I'd say the most important thing is to understand the power of circumstantial evidence.
Right. It's not always about having a smoking gun. It's about weaving together a convincing narrative based on the available evidence.
Exactly. Also, those single conspiracy factors, the common goal, the structure, the overlap in participants, those are crucial for distinguishing between one big conspiracy and a bunch of smaller ones.
And finally, those procedural aspects, the bill of particulars and the severance request, those can be really important tools for the defense, but they become much harder to win if the court is convinced that it's dealing with a single, unified conspiracy.
Absolutely. And as a final thought for our listeners, think about how these principles might apply in today's world with the rise of online crime, particularly in the drug trade.
That's a great point. Like, how do you prove a conspiracy when people are buying and selling drugs on the dark web where everything is more anonymous and decentralized?
Exactly. How do those traditional ideas of agreement and shared intent translate to a digital landscape where participants might be spread out all over the world, interacting only through online platforms? Does Cole still hold up in that context?
It's a fascinating question and one that I encourage everyone to ponder.
It definitely makes you think about how the law adapts, or maybe struggles to adapt, to the ever-changing world of crime. Thanks for this deep dive. It's been incredibly insightful.
My pleasure. Always happy to explore these fascinating legal puzzles.